All right, so the two books that I want to cover today is a, actually, I want to do a two-part series with it today and next week. On the theme, really, is about Rav Moshe Tshuva's, which discuss coming to America and kind of the gratitude that we should have towards America.
Oh, Thanksgiving.
Yep, and it's exactly the theme is it relates to Thanksgiving. And Rav Moshe certainly had the impression of someone who had come from Soviet Russia, beginning of his life, it was, you know, Tsarist Russia and then Soviet Russia. So he was able to really discuss and detail the differences in the treatment that the government had for its citizens in Russia versus the ones they had in the USSR versus the treatment they had for the citizens in America. And Rav Moshe really discusses that, and in particular, he's not just, he doesn't have like a treatise on it, but he does discuss it particularly in the context of the way that we should relate to America, relate to the policies of America. And we're going to discuss, there are a few tshuva where he discusses it. So I want to discuss one of them today. One of the ones which is a little less effusive on his praise of America. There's like a paragraph, we'll talk about it. But then what's... Yes.
His praise of America?
Yeah, his praise of the country, yeah. So his praise of America is a little less effusive in this context than it is, we'll discuss a bit more next week, and some other tshuvots. But what's perhaps significant about this tshuva is that he focuses on the way we should treat America in a very legal manner. And I'll explain what I mean as we go forward. But there's a way that he frames our appreciation of America, and he frames this entire question at hand because of his attitude towards how we should relate to the government of America. So the question at hand is as follows. Rav Moshe was asked the following question. We can read it inside. B'socher she'enu rotze latzeit mishum shekenu dina medina v'amaskar tzarech habayi la'atzmo. The question was asked as follows. Two Jews, there's one, a Jewish landlord and a Jewish tenant. And the landlord and the tenant had drawn up a lease. Let's say it was a 2-year lease. At the end of the 2 years, the landlord wants to evict the tenant. Maybe he wants to move in himself. Maybe he wants to improve it, raise the prices, raise the rent. And the tenant doesn't want to leave. The tenant wants to stay put. So the question was, or Moshe was asked, does the landlord have the right to evict the tenant? Because, here's the question, within purely a choshen mishpat, a pure, like you look at Shulchan Aruch, what does the law say based on like pure, you know, halacha? So the rule is that we follow the contract. If the contract is over, then as a squatter, you have no rights to remain, you know, on the property, and the landlord has the full right to evict the tenant. But within the laws of America, so there are a whole set of laws called tenant rights. You know, there are a whole set of rules for evictions. And while I'm no lawyer, and I don't actually know the history of exactly what the rules were in 1957 when he was asked, apparently the rule was at the time that it was difficult or it was illegal to just evict the tenant without any recourse, or you need to have certain provisions for when you could evict tenants. And so the motion's question being asked was, between two Jews, like there's no non-Jews involved here, it's really between two Jews, landlord and tenant, does the landlord have the right to follow halacha, or must the landlord follow the laws of the land, the laws of America? That's the question that Rav Moshe was asked. Any feelings, like how would you feel about this question? How would you guys respond? It was posed to you. We have a comment here. Our capital mentions that maybe it's a Dina Mahuta Dina question. Yeah, it's an interesting point. We'll talk about Dina Mahuta in a second.
You have laws in terms of, you know, depending on the side of the bill, you know, laws of rent stabilization. And then there was rent control back then, and there still is for some apartments. Rent stabilization only applies, and there are so many, there have to be so many units in the building. So if you're talking a 4-unit building, the laws don't apply. Mm-hmm. You know, the landlord could do anything he wants. You know, he could charge rent whatever he wants, and he could, you know, but if a stabilized tenant or a controlled tenant can't be kicked out.
Right.
You know, they have...
As long as they're paying their rent.
Yeah.
But even now, if you don't pay your rent...
Yeah. So, I mean, the question really becomes, though, what is the landlord's recourse? So, not as recourse, but does the landlord have to listen to follow the laws of America, or can he bring, you know, this guy to Basedin and say, like, hey, like, get out of my apartment?
that if the law doesn't really contradict halacha in a negative way that would undermine halacha, then you have to follow the laws of the land under what
here there is a clear contradiction.
There's a contradiction, but it doesn't hurt halacha in any way, and it doesn't make anybody over anything. Because if you have to let him stay, it's not you're not being over a law, and maybe you're not being able to exercise your right to do an act you're free to do under halacha, but not being over anything. It would seem to me, and it doesn't undermine halacha to let the guy stay. You know,
I mean, the landlord has rights, though. I mean, like, within halacha, so yeah. It's not that it's not. There's no like pure mitzvot for sure, but there is certainly.
The rent if it's caught, you know, based on halacha, would the rent have to stay the same?
Because halacha, the answer is no. Once the contract is over,
okay, fine.
Right, once the contract is over, the tenant has no right.
Says that he can raise it 2%. The law says he can raise it 2%. That he's allowed to raise it 2%. If he doesn't, he's going to get in big trouble. He could even, you know, he get fined. He could get sued.
Right. We're not talking about like the. I mean, there's certainly more complexities about the question of the. Of rent control and raising the rent, but even beyond rent, you know, let's say the landlord wants to, you know, renovate the apartment and, you know, or tear the whole building down.
Well, there's laws about that too. You know,
so I'm saying, so it's
building some other kind of building, yeah. Or that you're going to renovate up to such an extent that it costs X amount of money, then you're allowed to evict the guy, and if not, then you're not. So
yeah, there certainly is. The Ramosha's talking about there's certainly a set of cases in which the law, as on the books, especially at the time of 1957, and I'm sure even nowadays, you cannot evict someone, and this is especially true during COVID, like, you know, nowadays. And halacha does not really agree or accord with that type of conviction, that sense of what the tenant's rights are. The question becomes, between two Jews, really, how should we operate? That's Rav Moshe's real question. And what it really comes to, the nub of the matter here for Rav Moshe, is that this question is not solely about rent control. It's not just about tenant rights. It's really a question almost about how we, as Jews in America, see the laws of the land of America. Right? How do we relate to them? And this is a question which is, you know, it's not a novel question in the sense that, you know, Jews have been living in foreign lands for millennia already, and so they had to deal with foreign laws. As Ari Kapel mentioned, there's a whole set of rules called Dina Mechuta Dina. We have to follow the laws of the land. The truth is, though, the principle of Dina Mechuta Dina, it's a little bit limited. And there's a large debate within post-game exactly what the Dina Mechuta Dina apply. Does it apply to all laws? Does it apply maybe only some laws? Does it apply to laws that the king has? Maybe a democratic government it doesn't apply to. Maybe it only applies to laws like taxation, but not like some other things. There's a whole set of rules. It's a really big discussion, but Dina Mechuta Dina. And we'll see that Rav Moshe wants to kind of avoid discussion Dina Mechuta Dina. And he gives kind of two reasons for it. Let's go straight into it, why he wants to avoid Dina Mechuta Dina. But Dina Mechuta Dina is just general principle that we follow the rules of America, that even Choshen Mishpat has like an addendum to it, kind of like a footnote, like, hey, by the way, like we also have to follow the laws of the land. So you could have read this whole sugya, this whole question here at hand, based on that principle. But Rav Moshe wants to avoid it, and he gives two reasons for why he wants to avoid it. This is paragraph two. Hine mashi herich kvot rato binyan dina mechuto dina kasher lichtov binyanim elu mishnei tamim. There are two reasons I want to avoid basing my judgment, my particular answer here, based on Dina Mechuta Dina. One, Chada mitam shekata b'shut heishiv Moshe, shebi kvot rato, sheish mevuch rabba mina postgame v'stirot rabot. Because one explanation that someone quoted, that the person, the questioner, when he had brought this question to Moshe, he mentioned that there was a whole big debate within the postgame, within the different deciders, v'sarech lazei iun v'zman rav, ulai yazor Hashem, l'havin lasuki halacha, v'koshkin nektani erech kamoni. That there's a whole big debate, and it's very difficult, and it's a little bit difficult to find the right footing in this sugya, and I don't want to deal with it, especially for someone as small as me. So Rav Moshe almost has this like humble statement; he doesn't want to deal with it. I'll be honest, this is clearly just like Rav Moshe. It's really not like Rav Moshe's main principle here, because Rav Moshe in other sugyas clearly does. The other questions, and we will talk about at some point in the year, clearly does talk about Din Mahud Dina. He clearly knows the Sugya. I mean, he's a Moshe Feinstein. He clearly knows what he's talking about. This is not too difficult for him. But I think the main reason is because he wanted to avoid Din Mahud Dina entirely, and this was more of just like a pretense for the second reason. Because the real reason I think he wants to avoid Din Mahud Dina is for the following reason. And it's more of a theological, hashkafic explanation almost. V'od, mitam shebal yitra'eh chas v'shalom, she'anu makdinim kavod hamlucha de medinatenu Why don't I want to talk about Din Mahud Dina? Because there's something that happens when you talk about Din Mahud Dina. When you start talking about the legal specificities of like when exactly the laws of the land apply, when they don't apply, what you end up doing is you kind of get this sense that like you're very much, you know, in a legal frame of mind, but the larger sense of the conversation is that I don't really value the laws of the land for themselves. I don't really care about the values of America. I don't really care about America per se. I'm only doing this because there's like some technical legalities at play here, and I have to just follow the technical legalities. But I'm not really respecting or acknowledging the benefit that I got from America or why I should care about the values of America. And Rav Moshe is really arguing is that you shouldn't view it that way, especially in other Chuvos. Maybe we'll talk about this next week. He contrasts a little bit to like, you know, Tsarist Russia or the USSR, where there, laws of the land, the way we treat, you know, the government, it's a bit different, a little bit more antagonistic. They were more antagonistic towards us. We don't treat it the same way. But America is really a land, what he calls a Medina Shel Chesed, a land of kindness, a land where the basic framework of government is that government is for the people, by the people. It's something that's specifically done to benefit its citizens. And therefore, a government like that, we shouldn't have this attitude of let's find all the technical legalities. We should instead look at the land. We should look at the laws of the land as something that we want to opt into, right? And so we shouldn't look for these technical loopholes. We should kind of just like opt into it. And therefore, he explains that anachnu mechuyavim lakir lahem tova al hachesed shosim imanu im kol achinu bnei Yisrael shebimedina hazot. We are obligated. We have a tribute to acknowledge all of the kindness that this land has done for us, to Jewish people, to us and all our fellow Jews in this land. And we bless this land. And we pray for the land, right? As we pray, you know, on Shabbos for the Shalom of Dinah. So we pray every Shabbat and every day for the sake of the land that the officers of the land, as we are commanded to have this feeling of gratitude. And therefore, I don't want to extend any discussion within the realm of Dina Mahuta Dina. I want to avoid this technical legality question, which undermines this appreciation we have for the importance of America. Instead, I want to discuss this particular question while acknowledging how important the laws of America are for us and how they affect our well-being, how they affect our attitude towards land itself. Any questions so far? Great. So that's Rav Moshe's first statement. And it's really, I think, really significant. You know, as we're about to celebrate Thanksgiving, I think it's really significant. And I want to talk more about in the future, if not today, then next week, about Rav Moshe's impact in really acknowledging the importance of America, especially in contrast to other nations. You know, Jews have been exiled for thousands of years. For the large majority, they were not treated well. America is probably the best, arguably the best treatment Jews have had in a foreign land since, you know, ever. And therefore, it's very logical that Rav Moshe feels that he, in some ways, is almost taking his actual treatment, we'll see in a second, is not super novel, but it's the way he frames it is almost distinct in that he is, you know, this new posek in America. There were other posekim before him in America, but he becomes really this, you know, this large figure in America, and he's effectively dealing with a reality which is different than his predecessors, right? His predecessors who lived in Tsarist Russia, who lived in, you know, that was all these pogroms and, you know, all these the crusades and whatever else was happening. They didn't have the same attitude toward the foreign government. And even if they came out to the same conclusion that Moshe will end up having, the motivation here is a bit different. Their Moshe wants to emphasize how we should be thankful for the land and how our attitude, both in terms of the technical legalities, but also how we approach the law, how we approach Chol Shemishpat, should we only acknowledge the importance of America, the importance of the gratitude we must feel for the state. Absolutely. I think I don't know of any shuras where Moshe writes it explicitly. If I had to guess, I would say that Moshe thinks it's different. Not necessarily that the end game result is going to be different. He might have the same conclusions, but I don't think his attitude would be the same simply because we're not dealing with the government may be secular, but it's still a government of Jews. It's not a government of, you know, non-Jews imposing it upon us that we feel grateful in the same way. I mean, we can be grateful about the existence of Israel, but we're not grateful towards, you don't treat like, you know, Bennett or, you know, Ben Gurion the same way as he treats, you know, a non-Jewish government, which allows us by the graciousness of the government for us to be in this land. It's a little bit different way of
our attitude. Then he would probably revert to Dina to Machus Adina if he were passing the Shaila in Israel.
Probably. And in fact, we're not really learning the Chazon Ish, but in fact, the analysis we're going to discuss in a minute, the Chazon Ish, who lived in Bnei Brak, and other before Bnei Brak lived in, I think, Russia, was someone who very much disagrees with Moshe about Dina Chut Adina and about the principle we're about to talk about when it comes to how we align Chol Shemishpat with Jewish halacha, with the laws of the land. Because I think the Chazon Ish, living in the environment that he lived in, didn't believe that, he wasn't compelled the same way to acknowledge the land, the gracious of the land. And Chazon Ish lived in Israel, so he was like, no, we should really follow halacha, even if the government itself has a secular law. But Rav Moshe, living in America, had that sense of gratitude in a way that I don't think other poskim in Europe even had, because, I don't think in Poland in the 1700s, they felt the same gratitude toward the land the way that we do in America. Yeah.
Wow. How old was he in 1957, and how old was he when he came here?
I'm actually not sure. I could Google that in a second. Once I have my computer, I could actually.
The difference, I think, a younger person and an older person, their views change, and,
In a second. He was born in 1895, so in 50.
So he was 62.
Yeah, he'd be 62. Yeah, I think he's a bit older. I mean, I think people don't realize he lived in the USSR until he was like in his 40s.
Okay.
He was a rav in the community in USSR. He wasn't like he didn't come here as like a young guy. Okay. He was already fairly established. He's already a big Tanakh Chacham when he came here. So he definitely had like a lot of experience, and he knew firsthand what USSR looked like, not just as a child, but even as like an adult and as a communal leader who understood like the policies of the land, the way they affected communities. So he definitely has like a very good sense of the differences between the approaches. Yeah. So I want to continue. So now, that's Rav Moshe's first pass where he says doesn't want to talk about Dina Machus Adina. He wants to have this general attitude of where the attitude of being thankful, gracious towards the land of America is going to inform us how we decide as halacha. That's kind of his first general principle. How does he decide his actual halacha at the end of the day? So he wants to do is the following, and it's not the most creative thing he does, but it's fairly creative and it's very impactful in the way we treat laws in America, because he says as follows. Aval aniyut dati, this is in the third paragraph, that says as follows. Aval aniyut dati be'uvda zu de'asud medinat machuta she'maskir ein yachol lahutzi et ha'socher af achar she'kal tazmano kol zman she'otz la'dur sham. So he doesn't write, this is a little less clear in terms of his writing, but he's going to argue the following, that he thinks when it comes to any laws which were enacted after the, any laws which were enacted, sorry, any laws were enacted before the contract was first drawn up, right? Before the law was on the book in 1940, and in 56 or whatever, the tenant moves into this apartment. So any laws which were already on the books, he thinks that Dina Chuzi Dina will be relevant to some extent. But any laws on the, which are on the books only later, there Dina Chuzi Dina is not really relevant because, you know, you didn't come into the situation with Dina Chuzi Dina. You didn't have the law already, you already didn't have the law. It's a little bit going in the weeds here a little bit of exactly what timing we're talking about.
I mean, that makes sense to me because if the law was on the books, then you could say any contract, even though it says whatever it says, is still within the constraints of the law, and that should be assumed because you can't do a contract that violates the law if you're doing Dina Bilochus Adina. So therefore, that's already written into the contract, you know, sub silentio, without actually being written into the contract.
So actually, he's going to exactly go into this question. It's his entire point is going to be that at the end of the day, he thinks, this is going to be his major idea, that he thinks that when people draw up contracts, when people make agreements in America, they primarily operate based on the common customs in the land. What do people do? And so even if it's, regardless of what's on the books, if the common custom on the land is that tenants can stay, you know, in their apartments for, you know, way after the lease ends, then that's what people assumed when they first made their agreement.
It's more stronger than Dina Demachus Adina, even if it weren't the
yeah,
law.
Yeah, he actually thinks it's very expansive. And so effectively, Dina Demachus, the law of the land are obviously going to inform what the custom is. You know, the average, you know, Joe on the street is going to follow what the laws of the land are. You know, the rent evictions and laws are going to follow the laws, you know, state of the city of New York City. But at the end of the day, what matters is not so much, at least for this analysis, what the laws are, as much as what everyone does. What is the common custom when it comes to, you know, rent agreements? And based on what the common custom is, that we're going to assume is what the two people who came to the agreement, what were they thinking at the time, right? What are the agreements that are implied within the agreement, within the contract? And so that's his basic argument. He says as follows. In the beginning, he's a little bit like in the weeds, so I want to skip it a little bit. It's a little bit more complicated in the beginning, almost unnecessarily. It's a little bit less clear. But he goes through and skips to like the middle of the third paragraph, and he says that at some point, that he makes the following point. Aval le'elu shesachru achar shekvar nasa din me'malchut ve'lo hinu beferush kishyavu azman. For those who decided to start the rent after the din of the malchut already started, right, after the law is already on the books, but they didn't explicitly make any conditions, there was no point where they explicated what exactly that they're going to follow these laws. Nonetheless, we're going to say that stam havekihinu shadata din malchut, we're going to say that they presumably they followed the dot of the malchut, that in their minds, when they made this agreement, what were they thinking? They were thinking to follow the laws of the land. So then you might ask, if it's true that you're just going to follow the laws of the land, so then what is the point of a lease? What is the significance of a lease? So he argues the point of a lease is it protects the landlord, that the landlord is incapable of, that the tenant, sorry, cannot leave the apartment for the duration of the lease, right? So the based on these laws of the land, the landlord is never allowed to evict the tenant. But, I mean, that's his reading of the laws of the land. Obviously, the lawyers at the time would have to debate the exact details. But the landlord is protected that the duration of the lease, the tenant cannot leave and stop paying rent. The landlord is assured that during the duration of the lease, he will be paid rent. As well as the lease also guarantees something else. He adds as follows also, V'chein hu shelo yuchal maskil rabot b'demea, af kishinu amalchut reshut lehosif. Lease to something else, a secondary thing, is that during the period of the lease, the landlord is not allowed to raise the price of the rent. Even if the government passes some law which states that landlords are allowed to raise the rent, you know, 2% because of inflation or something in the middle of the lease, Regardless, the lease is going to be the final say, and you're not going to be allowed to contradict the lease and raise the rent when the lease says that the rent is stable at, you know, whatever price it is for the for that duration.
There's a COLA.
What?
If there's a cost of living adjustment in there.
Yeah, so if the lease states something explicitly that we're going to adjust based on, you know, certain metrics, then you're just following the lease. But he's arguing that at the end of the day, the lease is going to be the lease agreement, this contract, it's going to be the most binding agreement. And regardless of any other outside forces, the law of the land, that's not going to affect the lease.
This might be a really uninformed question, and you might have also addressed them in the beginning, but why should Rav Moshe Feinstein even be ruling on this to begin with? Why don't we just follow what the law is? So, for instance, what we just said, the government allows you to increase the lease amount. Why can't we just say we follow that? Why does he even have to give his opinion?
We didn't address it specifically. I guess it's...
Well, you did. You said under halacha, the contract binds. If there was no law of the land, yeah, whatever the lease says would be binding.
But in this case, the law of the land...
So we're talking about two Jews here. Yeah. If it was a Jew and a non-Jew, it'd be more complicated, although presumably you'd follow just the law of the land. It's a little bit more complicated. But between two Jews, the kind of the initial assumption of the guy asking the question was, you know, I'm Jewish, he's Jewish, why should I be bound by America's laws? I should be able to follow Choshen Mishpat. You know, pull out the Shulchan Aruch, what does it say in Shulchan Aruch? What does the Jewish law say? And the Jewish law says that...
But do we generally do that, where, like, we don't need to impose our Jewish law, where there's already, like, a civil law in place that we could go by, that we...
Well, you're kind of coming from this attitude of civil law is here, why Jewish law only adds on.
Right.
I think the attitude of most halachic Jews is the other way around. If anything, like halacha is halacha, and like why do I care about the American laws? Why do I care about?
Sorry, Dash, is in place if we have like a Jewish state or a Jewish government.
Halacha is always in place. I mean, generally speaking, if you have a case that you want to bring against a Jew for money, you're really supposed to take to a beit din and not go to a civil court. You know, with courts, you have to know a lot about, which Rabbi Zolti knows more about than I do, but I mean, it would take us an hour to discuss all of that, if not more.
No, for sure. So I know this was like an uninformed question.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, it's important.
We did that with the caterer.
Yeah, we took him to a beit din instead of suing him in court.
Yeah, we won. We won wherever we went, but we never got any money.
We did file that in the civil
court. I don't know the drama of what happened around.
But no, but it is an important question, and there's certainly this like almost an attitude that you know, American laws, like naturally, if you're born into American laws, you should assume that those are binding.
Of course, if it's counter to Jewish law, then there's
a question. The problem is that it often is counter. If it's not,
we're not educated enough to realize it's counter.
Yeah. And I mean, the Moshe here is not discussing it, but there are certain cases where we're not so obvious that we follow American law. To give you like a case which is it's fairly accepted among posts, even though it's not everyone does it. But when it comes to like inheritance laws, you know, wills and the like, America has a certain principle how inheritance works, and Jewish law is a very different principle of law of how inheritance works, and ideally, really shouldn't be following the laws of the land. You really should follow Jewish law. Now, it becomes very complicated because you might also not love the way Jewish law works because, you know, daughters don't really get inheritance.
If you're not the firstborn.
You're not the firstborn. You don't get the double portion. Yeah. There are all these things. So there are ways to, you know, work around that and express your wishes as, you know, as the, you know, as the deceased, as the...
And it's a halachic will you can make.
You can make a halachic will, but but you can't just argue to, like, obviate the need of a halachic will and just follow the laws of the land, because it's not clear that the laws of the land are binding.
Well, what's also complicated here is that the two parties have to also, like, clearly want to follow Jewish law, because if one party wants to follow the U.S. law, they can immediately bring it to court and, like, override the Jewish...
Yeah, I mean, you could... Obviously, there's only so much you can do as a court in terms of... And then that's why often Jewish law, the way that works in like Beis Din, is that you sign a binding arbitration agreement. In the Beis Din doesn't have like legal jurisdiction to enforce things other than having his binding arbitration. And there are some things, arbitration courts. And so what often will happen is you bring someone to Beis Din, they'll make the party sign in advance voluntarily, you know, to sign our binding arbitration agreement. Once they sign his binding arbitration agreement, then what Beis Din says matters enough such that if the party then reneges and says like, oh, I don't like the decision, I'm not going to follow it, then basically be like, hey, you signed this contract. They'll bring the case to a civil court, and then the civil court will say we'll follow the binding arbitration agreement.
is what Moshul is with the caterer.
You're right. At the end of the day, if you don't want to go to Beistin, you're going to say no, then there's nothing we can do about it.
If they're both from people, the Beistin could put you in Harem if you don't follow.
We don't have as much power nowadays, Beistin, as they used to, but in function, we should. Ideally, if there are two Jews, really, you should go to Beistin. And
right, I guess that's what modern Orthodoxy means. But yes,
There's a guy who used to be in our show. There's a star seruv against him for failing to go to the Beis Din when, and they're both from guys, when one guy sued him in the Beis Din and he wouldn't show up. And there's a star seruv against him.
Oh, wow.
What's a star seruv?
That means it's a thing saying you can't let him into the show, he can't participate in communal affairs, etc. So the Beis Din has some within the Jewish community. Sorry to be speaking in front of the Rav.
I don't know the difference here.
They do that sometimes with men who won't give women gets. They do a star seruv against him, and nobody's allowed. He's not allowed into the shul. There's another guy who won't give his wife a get. He's not allowed in the shul.
The rabbi
shuls have to sign
the old shul. It was before Rabbi Robinson. And the guy used to sit next to me, weekdays. Then he didn't come back. He goes,
Most shuls sign a grievance, so to speak, with the Beis Din that they're, is it known that
The Beis Din just puts out the Star Seruv and the shul is supposed to follow it. The problem is they don't usually circulate it to enough of the shuls, so the guy gets from the shul down the block. But if they send it to all the shuls in the neighborhood, then it would have some effect.
Not every shul listens to the Beis Din also. Right. Complicated.
It seems like we're starting to get into the weeds.
More like the sociological realities, similar to Agunas, where ideally every good Jew would say that, based in Paskins, that this person is a Messiah of Get or Messiah of Beis Din, someone who refuses, a Get refuser, then they shouldn't be given any kibbutim, they shouldn't be allowed in the community. In practice, though, money talks, not every community is as upright as it should be, unfortunately. Either way, though, Moshe, going back to our topic, Moshe wants to argue, in effect, that the laws of the land are going to matter for us because they impact the way we think and we come naturally into an agreement. And he says as follows, and he adds on to this. He adds the following point. He says, where's his source for this? Where's this idea come from? So this is the fourth paragraph. He argues it comes from this Mishnah in Bav Metzia. Because Mishnah says as follows, V'agir atzmecha, De'abarur pashut shekol edo adinim atzulim v'minag ha'medina, every law, which is what's called dependent upon minag hamedina, the customs of the land, the customary practice, the way people operate. So where is the source for this? It comes from Mishnah and Bava Metzia, which says as follows, Makom shinagush lo lehashkim lo shleharev, eno rashai lekufan. So the Mishnah says as follows when it comes to hiring workers, right? So they used to have certain practice, they would hire day workers to hire, someone to, harvest your grain or something of the like. And so they had certain customs of the land, like what it would mean for most typical employment to hire someone for the day. And so the Mishnah says, in a place where the minhag was, that you weren't allowed to force the worker to come before daybreak, before sunrise, and you weren't allowed to, the custom was that they weren't allowed to work after sunset, right? They worked from 9 to 5 or, whatever now it is, like 7 to 4:30, those were the hours that they used to work. They didn't work any longer than that. And so in such a scenario, you're not allowed to force them to work longer than those hours. Of course, you could stipulate with them in advance, I'm going to pay you more if you work longer hours. But you can't, once the agreement's already made, you're going to work for me today, say by the way, I meant for you to agree to work longer than those hours. Because they'll say, no, we meant when we started that agreement that we would follow the regular typical custom. The typical form of employment was 7 to 4:30 and nothing else. You can't come in later on and suggest something different. There are other Mishnah that make the similar point. Similarly, Gemara Bava Metzia said something else about when it comes to what type of employment you agree to. If the minhag is I hire people to how exactly I operate, right? What exactly the typical practices when it comes to tilling a field, what type of work should be done. And all of these practices are based on minhag hamedina. And in fact, he doesn't quote this, but it's actually very relevant. The Yerushalmi on this Mishnah makes this statement that becomes very significant. If you want to turn to page 2, I quoted it in source 2. And the Yerushalmi quotes this Mishnah, And the Gemara says as follows. This is a phrase which kind of resounds throughout halacha. Amar Rav Hoshea, this is the underlined part of source 2. Zot Omeret, this principle teaches us, HaMinhag Mevatel et HaHalacha. This teaches us this principle that Minhag, the way that the custom of the land works, it nullifies halacha.
But only if halacha is stricter. Like if halacha...
Well, both ways. If the Minhag is...
Sorry, only if halacha is more lenient.
Well, even if halacha is stricter, it'd be true too. Even if halacha, even if Choshen Mishpat, I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example where it comes up. So Moshe
discussing with the lease and then raising the rent, if the minhag of the country allows that to raise, they pass a new law where you could raise the rent even when the lease has already been signed. We said you shouldn't do that before.
Yeah, well, that was the you can't raise rent. Yeah.
Right, but the minhag of the country was suddenly to pass a new law that you can raise the rent.
Yeah, so in that case, you wouldn't follow. You'd still follow the lease, though.
Right. So in that case, the minhag of the doesn't nullify.
That's because the lease is the most binding agreement. The lease agreement is going to be the most significant deciding factor. Because ultimately, what matters about the minhag is really a question of what were the conditions that you assumed when you made the agreement to begin with.
Once the agreement's in place.
It's not that there are, in Ramosha's framework, and there are other ways to argue this, but in Ramosha's mind, it's not that Minhag Medina is inherently significant. It's more that it informs what you were thinking when you made an agreement, right? Two people come to an agreement, what were they thinking? And in Ramosha's mind, they're not just thinking about, what does it say in Choshen Mishpat? What they're actually thinking about, probably in America, is what do people do? What is the average custom? And the average custom is going to follow the laws of America. The law is what everyone does. You know, two people make an agreement, they make a sale, right? I go to a Jewish store owner and I buy challahs or something. So I buy those challahs. I'm not thinking like, oh, by the way, halacha thinks that like the following happens and like, you know, I get the money back. Like nobody's thinking those terms. I'm thinking to myself, you know, if I get bad challahs, I'm making this mass order and I get bad challahs, I'm going to sue this person based on the laws of the state of New York. Right? No one thinks that's the agreement that people assume when they come to make contracts or verbal agreements between two individuals. And so that's why the contract really becomes this most significant factor. What is actually written in the contract?
But once you're saying once the contract is made, there it's like stricter if we could refute what.
Yeah. Yeah. You,
beforehand,
in terms of evaluating what kind of gets added to the contract, what was what was the assumed mindset of the individuals, we assume that they followed the minhag of the land. That's kind of the assumption. Yeah. So, and he goes even further than this. He suggests that this is true. In fact, there even is, in the middle of paragraph 4, he says as follows, V'chein hu binyanei mechira mahu bichlal ha-mecher. This is true even when it comes to what is included in a sale. Because the Mishnah, if you want to look at source 3 on page 2, there's a whole list of Mishnayot in Bava Batra that discuss what happens when you buy a house. Or you buy a field, or you buy all sorts of boat. What's included in that purchase, right? This is true in American law. Every piece of law has to talk about this. I buy a house, right? What is included when I buy the house? Does it include the airspace above the house? Does it include all the land below the house? What if someone wants to run a pipe, 100 meters below my house, right? Who owns that dirt? What if somebody wants to fly a plane above my house, right? Who owns the airspace above my house? Right, so there's all sorts of laws about what is included when you buy the house. Or better yet, buy the house, does it come with the fridge? Does it come with an oven? Does it come with, or is it assumed that those the oven and the fridge are properties of the seller, the original landlord, and that they go with him, so to speak, and they weren't included in the sale. Right, so what things are included in the sale, what things are not, when they're not stipulated, right? No one writes by the house and says, like, it includes the fridge, it includes all these things.
Actually, sometimes they do.
Sometimes they might, yeah.
Or sometimes they say it doesn't.
Yeah, sometimes they might take explicit, but...
You've got to say something.
A lot of times they'll say as is.
Right. It's a more comprehensive contract.
As is wouldn't apply to appliances.
More comprehensive contracts might include all the details. But they're not always so comprehensive. So the question becomes, if they weren't comprehensive, what's assumed? So the Mishnah of Bava Batra lists out all these rules. There's a whole list of rules, what needs to be. And Rav Moshe makes this statement that none of those rules matter to us nowadays. Like, there's no reason to learn the whole fourth and fifth parak of Bava Batra. because they don't really matter to us at all. Because nowadays, we don't care about what they did in, you know, in the second century in Babylonia. Like, who cares what they practiced back then? Nowadays, I care about the state of New York, like, what is included in the sale? Is the fridge included or is not included? And, like, for instance, right, in America, I think most places when you buy a house, the oven comes with the house. In Israel, for instance, the oven often does not come with the house. And so it's not because in America we follow halacha and they don't follow halacha. It's because it's just going to make a difference. That what's going to be the binding factor is just what is the custom. Is an oven considered to be integral to the house, or is it, you know, an appliance that's similar to a couch that moves with the owner? So Rav Moshe argues that the whole second paragraph, fourth paragraph of Batra is also being based on Minhagim. And he says as follows, the end of paragraph four, about Makom Shish, that the only reason the whole thing is mentioned, why is it even included in Shulchan Aruch? The Hurak B'Makom Shein Minhag. The reason to include these things in the Shulchan Aruch is just to tell us what happens if there is no custom, right? You move to an island. What do you do if there's an island and there's no, you know, consensus what the minhag is? So then you follow halacha, then you follow what Choshen Mishpat says. But assuming there is a minhag, Makom Sheish Minhag, Holkin Achra Minhag, you follow the minhag. And why is this true? Because as he mentioned earlier, and he's going to repeat this principle a few times, Ve'atam should be Stamahu Kehitnu Shehu Kam Minhag. Because we assume that they made an agreement based on the minhag. That is the assumed assumption of what the two individuals who entered into this agreement, what were they thinking at the time? Presumably they were thinking we're going to follow the common customs of the land. Now Rav Moshe is going to make the following interesting point. So that's great. We've established the importance of minhag. The question becomes, who determines the minhag? Right? What type of minhagim are relevant? Because you could have argued three things. You could have argued it's only going to depend upon from Jews. Right? From Jews make agreement. What do we do as from Jews? What does the, you know, Orthodox community do? You could have argued maybe it'll be based on what everyone in the world does. Right? It's not going to make a difference what the Jews particularly do, but it maybe matters all, even the non-Jews. So in the state of New York, I'm not going to care only about, you know, the Jewish Orthodox population. I'm going to care about everyone. The third possibility is you could have said it's not only even from Jews. It's going to make a difference. What's going to matter is actually those things which have some type of gushpanka of the Chachamim, some type of certification by rabbinic figures of some sort which agree to this practice, right? So, you know, the state of New York may legislate certain rent laws. And perhaps that's even the custom not only among the non-Jews, but even among the Jews. But maybe like no particular, you know, rabbi or scholar agreed that these are just laws. Right? So maybe the only minhagim we care about are those which have some type of certification, some type of agreement that the Chachamim think, yeah, this is a right minhag, this is a correct minhag, this is a minhag we should follow. Right? Who says the minhagim are, you know, of the people, maybe minhagim that matter, that have legal binding, are only those which are maybe of the people, but written by the scholars, by the, you know, by the plutocrats.
Sorry for all my interruptions today, but wouldn't that puts like an extra responsibility on the rabbis to have to review every single law that's put out if they want to have a rabbinic consensus?
I guess ideally that would be true, but I think that here we're talking about the cases already presented in front of us. So the question becomes more a question of, like, you know, the rent control laws here in question, right? Did some rabbi agree that these laws make sense? Did they think that this law in question was a right, correct law? So the truth is that Rav Moshe is going to admit that there is one position who does believe that the laws, the minhag, has to be certified by some type of what he calls Chachmei HaMakom, the elders of the place. It's a minhag kavua, has to IP Chachmei HaMakom. It's a set minhag which was done by the Vatikin, by the elders, by the people who are, you know, the wisest people of the land. The sages have agreed to that custom. That's, he's going to admit that there is such an opinion. But first, he's going to say two things. First, he thinks that no one else agrees with this opinion. The Mordechai, the Ashri in this context, is a dat yachid. For the most part, the Rambam, he goes in, this is in paragraph 5, if you want to read it, he says that everyone else seems to disagree with this, and that the minhag, it doesn't make a difference who establishes the minhag. Minhags, at the end of the day, are not actually legally binding based on legislation. They're not, you know, they're not statutes. Rather, they are based on common practice. We really care about what the average Joe does on the street. That's what matters for minhagim. they don't have to be, you know, agreed upon by Chachamim, which isn't true in all cases. When it comes to, we use the word minhag in a lot of contexts, when it comes to the role of minhagim in like purely ritual contexts, so there we're not going to be as quick to say that like the average Joe has a say in what minhagim are. Just because the average Joe decides that, you know, every day we start Shemona Esrei by banging on the table four times doesn't mean that that becomes like a real minhag that has like halachic significance. Yeah, but it doesn't. But I'm saying it doesn't have like. But if someone decides to do it every single day, that's not going to make a difference unless, you know, it becomes consensus among, you know, the rabbinic leaders of that generation. But the average Joe doesn't really have a say in the same way that they do when it comes to Oshi Mishpat issues, when it comes to transactions between individuals, where their emotion thinks that the Minhag HaMakom is really going to be based not on the sages, but rather it's going to be based on the populace. What does the average Joe do in these situations? That's kind of argument one. Argument two, it goes a little bit in the weeds, but he actually argues that it's truthfully, truth to be told, he thinks even the Ashri here, even this one opinion, is actually kind of limited in context. And this kind of, I'll just explain a little bit because I think it's interesting to talk about. He thinks that when does this come out, right? When do issues like Minhag HaMakom come up? It comes up in when something is being contested, right? When somebody brings you to court and contests the existence of this minhag. And so what happens in the following case? What happens if two people come to court, right? Moshe gives his psak, right? You know, in 1957, he was asked this question, and Moshe says, we follow minhag HaMakom, we follow the place of the land. Okay, so now, you know, the landlord, or maybe his landlord's friend, is a little bit of a wise guy, and he comes, and he has a similar case that comes up the next year. And he goes through Moshe and says, like, I know you said we follow the meaning of the land, but I want to tell you, I read your tshuva, I knew about it, and when we drew up this contract, I thought to myself, I am not following the meaning of the land. And I said it out loud, we're not following the meaning of the land, we're following halacha of Choshen Mishpat. What happens then? And the other guy, the tenant, says, no, what are you talking about? You never said that. We didn't agree to that. That was not part of the agreement. So who's correct? Who do we follow? Who do we believe in that scenario? Because facts on the ground, if there was such an agreement made that they weren't going to follow the laws of the land, they were going to follow Choshen Mishpat, then everyone agrees he wouldn't follow Choshen Mishpat, he wouldn't follow the laws of the land, he'd follow Choshen Mishpat, because he followed the agreement. And the agreement was follow Choshen Mishpat. If, though, there was no such stipulation made, then you follow the base law, which the basic assumption of laws of the land. And so the question becomes, who do you believe? Do you believe the landlord in that scenario, or do you believe the tenant, right? So this is almost the question becomes, who has the burden of proof? Who has to prove that there was such a stipulation made that we don't follow the laws of the land? And so Ramosha is going to argue that that particular question, that narrow issue about who do we believe, who has the burden of proof, is going to be the debate in the Rishonim. That's what the Haggadah Shri, this one opinion, believes, that the burden of proof is going to be upon the tenant. Because, and this is his argument, he explains why, that according to his one opinion, burden of proof is on the tenant. This was page two already. V'tam chaluk hagot ashri. This is the first big paragraph on page two. Nira desover de'en lehakish me'um denak mo v'neged edim ela kishesh avla b'mash matnim neged haminag. Because Ramoshi argues that we assume that a person, the only reason a person would lie and suggest that we don't make this minhag is because we don't assume that we follow the minhag naturally unless there's some type of wrongdoing. There's something wrong. And what he's arguing, in effect, is that when a minhag is certified, when a minhag is certified by the sages, by the elders of the place, so then in those scenarios, we can assume that the minhag is a correct minhag, right? It's a justified minhag. It's something which, it's not just that this is the custom, but it's something that feels like it's correct. It's morally just. And in those scenarios, where the moral just is going to be assumed to be the assumed assumption of any contract, unless explicitly stipulated and agreed upon by all parties. But in a scenario where the custom of the land is not necessarily morally just, right, it could be that the custom of the land is, you know, that tenants get evicted. And maybe, I'm not going to particularly give my positions on the issue, but maybe you believe, maybe this becomes consensus belief, is that truthfully moral correctness would actually follow the landlords. Maybe landlords are correct morally. The just system would actually follow the landlords and allow them to evict their tenants. And so what Rav Moshe is arguing is that for this one opinion would believe that in scenarios where the minhag of the makom is binding, but it's not actually morally correct, then when there is a dispute about whether or not such a minhag, a stipulation was made, whether we should follow the minhag or not, so in that case, then the burden of proof is going to be on following the minhag. Because to follow, if there's a dispute about whether or not we agree to a particular stipulation, we're going to assume that the burden of proof is going to be on the opinion that that we're going to do something against what feels morally correct.
And is the assumption of whether it's morally correct, is that just like common thought?
Or so who defines morally correct? According to the Haggadot Shri, in this particular position, is morally correct is going to be something which was certified by the sages. That if the rabbis, the sages, the elders of the community decided that this was something, a correct practice, then we're going to assume that that's, you know, morally correct, and the burden of proof is going to be upon the other position to, that they stipulated against this practice. If though the sages, the elders, at no point certified this minhag, they didn't say that this minhag was a correct minhag, then we're going to assume that it's not necessarily a morally correct minhag, and the burden of proof, if there's a dispute about who made this, about whether such a stipulation was made, is going to be upon the person that suggests we follow the minhag. That's this one opinion. I went through a little bit the weeds here of like the detail of that opinion, because I think it's just an interesting question of when we care about burden of proof. But at the end of the day, Rav Moshe thinks this is still a one-sided opinion, and for the most part, we're not going to follow this opinion. We're going to suggest that the laws of the land hold and are binding. And not only are they binding, but even in cases of dispute about whether or not such a resolution was made, whether a stipulation was made to go against the minhag, even in those scenarios, we're still going to follow. The burden of proof is going to be on the landlord to go against the laws of the land, against the Ashrei, against this one opinion. Any questions so far? Great. So Hamos Michaber Lavaraya is a general principle, right, for everyone else. General principle which states that if you want to extract money from someone, then you need to bring proof, right? You know, if Aliza and I are arguing about whose gloves those are, I say those are my gloves, that, you know, and she says it's her gloves. So because the gloves are currently in her hand, so Hamos Michaber Lavaraya, I have to bring proof that they're actually my gloves, right? The burden of proof is upon me and not upon her in the particular scenario. The question becomes, though, often in cases like who is considered to be called the muhzak? Who is the person who is assumed to have the property in his possession at the time? Right? That kind of becomes the question in a lot of these issues. And so here, too, the question becomes, right, who is the muhzak, landlord or the tenant? Right? Who is Hamotim Mechaber Lavaraya going against? And so the principle actually within the Gemara and this principle of minhag is actually that the Motim Mechavero is actually the person going against the minhag. That the minhag establishes that the person following the minhag is the muhzak. They are the standard bearer, and anyone going against the minhag, it's upon them to bring proof. Right, they are the ones who have to, you know, contradict that minhag. That answer your question? Yeah. Okay. So the last thing I want to say is something interesting at the end. He makes the point. He went through the same tshuva. He kind of summarizes at the very end. He says as follows, very, and this is kind of, it's just an interesting point. It's actually kind of a big question to ask in Rosha. He makes the following point. Ach shemati, shemidina manchu, chimtsar chamaski la'atmo, yachol lehotzio. So he goes back and forth on the details. He summarizes it. And he makes the following point at the end. I actually just heard as I was writing this tshuva that it could be that, the laws of the land are actually not exactly as I described them. And it could be that if the landlord needs the house, right? So in halacha, if the landlord needs the house, assuming the lease is not, you know, assuming there's no lease, pre-binding lease agreement, then the landlord will be able to evict the tenant. And he had been till now arguing or assuming that even in such a scenario, even if the landlord himself needs to live in this particular dwelling, he wouldn't be able to evict the tenant. And he says at the end, actually, I might have heard that maybe the law is not like that. Maybe the landlord would be able to evict the tenant in a scenario where the landlord himself wanted to live in that apartment. And therefore, because the law of the land is a little bit in question, and therefore you have to ask someone, you have to ask a lawyer, you have to ask people who know the laws of the land and find out from them, you know, what are laws of the land? What is the proper law in terms of eviction rates, evictions for tenants. But he makes the following point at the end. Shehu Adam Kasher, that applies to an Adam Kasher. You can ask like a lawyer who's just. But ki al ha-shofet ein lismoch, ein lam cheskat kashrut. When it comes to asking a judge, you cannot ask a judge because a judge does not have cheskat kashrut. Judges are not considered to be loyal people. They're not considered to be trustworthy people. And it's possible that a judge may lie either intentionally or unintentionally. And therefore, you shouldn't ask a judge about what the laws of the land are when it comes to tenant rights. You should ask like a lawyer who's a upstanding citizen, upstanding lawyer. This is a really a fascinating statement. Why is there Moshe so against judges? It's a question that I've never heard an answer.
I've never been in housing court before.
Yeah. I'm not sure why the judges are inherently considered to be more just than lawyers in this context, but that's Ramosha's contention here. Definitely wants to think about what is Ramosha talking about, like what is the frame of reference that he's thinking about, but it's certainly a question, and it goes back kind of to original question. It's kind of the reason it's kind of a big question. It goes back to our initial point in the beginning about Ramosha kind of talking about how great America is. If America is so great, how are their judges so corrupt? So it's an interesting question to ask on Ramosha. But I'll leave it at that. It's kind of a question on Rav Moshe. But in sum, I think Rav Moshe's main argument here is a well-argued point, which both situates halacha in a position where we have a certain gratitude towards America. We recognize that America's laws matter to us. The values of America should matter to us. And they matter in such a way that they establish how we conduct ourselves, that they matter in how the minhag of our land, how we operate between us as individuals. Those means of operation are going to be determined by the minhag of the land, by the way that the values of America. And America is significant in a way that, you know, other countries might not have been. You know, back in old Europe, back in during the Crusades, during the pogroms, it's not clear to me that Rav Moshe would say the same argument. Minhag HaMakom might not apply the same way, or we might not follow, you know, what the average Joe does on the street, the average non-Jew, you know, Christian, does on the street, because we don't really care about the land the same way, and we're not going to those values, the way that those lands, those laws operate, are not going to, you know, seep into Jewish life in the same way that they do seep into Jewish life here in America, because we kind of become, you know, proud American citizens, where we're thankful to the land, thankful to its laws, and we want to encourage everyone to follow its laws in all parts of our daily life.